This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, May 24th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Today, we're inaugurating the first episode of The Challengers, a monthly segment devoted to the 2018 midterm races across the country. We'll focus especially on candidates who are new to politics as a way of discussing upheavals outside Washington and defining issues that are shaping the futures of the two major parties. We're starting with Texas, which has been controlled by Republicans for more than two decades. In 2016, Trump carried the state by 10 points. The GOP holds the governor's office, the state legislature, two-thirds of its House districts, and both seats in the Senate. It wasn't always this way, however. For over a century, Texas was a solid blue state. And this year, for the first time since 1992, Democrats are fielding candidates in every congressional race in the state. Beto O'Rourke has mounted an insurgent campaign against Ted Cruz. And this Tuesday, a wide range of candidates won primary runoffs in some of the state's most competitive House districts. Gina Ortiz Jones is running a competitive race in a district that encompasses the San Antonio suburbs and much of southeast Texas. This is her first time running for office, and if elected, she'll be the first Iraq War veteran, the first Filipina American, and the first lesbian to represent Texas in Congress. In an interview with Millennial Politics, Ortiz Jones spoke about how the Republican right has looked to Texas to implement some of its most hardline policies and how this has spurred outsider candidates like her to run.
There is a change across the country. I think we're seeing some of that in Texas as well. And I think we are seeing, you know, some of that change in Texas maybe more acutely just because, you know, we are having to disproportionately experience the effect of these poor, poor policies. Right. Texas has three of the top 10 largest cities in the nation. Right. Why my state can put people on the moon, but we have the highest mortality rate in the developed world is beyond me.
Lawrence Wright joins me to discuss how the radical right seized control of Texas, how Democrats might take it back, and how the state became a bellwether for American politics. Larry, thank you so much for coming on.
It's always a pleasure, Dorothy.
You grew up in Dallas, and you've lived in Austin for longer than I've known you, which is some decades by now. The state always has had this strong grip on the American imagination. It's big, it's rich, and it's gleefully rude and raunchy. You recently published a book called God Save Texas. What did you learn in doing the reporting for that book that you didn't already know?
Well, you know, it all started with our editor, David Remnick, calling me into his office and asking me to explain Texas. You know, I felt like I'd been called into the principal's office, you know, and many of my colleagues are puzzled by the fact that I do live in Texas, although I grew up here.
Well, and Austin, we should add, is hardly typical.
Okay, I know that everybody says that, and you know, and when people say, you know, where are you from? And I say Texas, a lot of times it's like saying I cheat on my taxes or something like that. It's like, how dare you, sir? But if I say I'm from Austin, it seems forgivable in some way. But it really is a, you know, it's a very Texas place. You couldn't put Austin down anywhere else and expect it to be like Illinois or Delaware. It's certainly an expression of the culture of Texas.
You write in the book about AM Texas and FM Texas, and I thought that was a really helpful way of sort of explaining the phenomenon that is Texas. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, I think most people outside of Texas have this, you know, kind of a unilateral view of what the state is, and it corresponds to what you hear on AM radio, especially in Texas. You know, but it's true all over America. You know, we have Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham and our own contribution, Alex Jones. And yes, that you can drive through the state and listen to that. And the state you will be in is an incredibly reactionary, illiberal, evangelical creation, which is corresponds to what people think of Texas in many ways. But you could also drive through the state and listen to the FM band And FM Texas is a lot like, FM America. You know, it's urbane, it's progressive, it's cosmopolitan. And, you know, Texas is more urban than any other state in America. But, you know, when you're out in the country where the FM band doesn't reach, you're in AM Texas. And it is, you know, the red state that everybody imagines. But when you enter the city limits of any city in the whole state, the politics and the culture changes abruptly.
So there has been this well-defined shift in demographics in Texas over the last couple of decades. But as that has occurred, the legislature has been taken over by right-wing zealots. You saw this happen. Could you just take us a little bit through that history?
Yeah, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, Texas used to be blue when I was young. It was an entirely Democratic state in the same way that it is entirely at the statewide level Republican now. What changed that? I had a conversation with Carl Rove, who is another Austin resident and has done so much to change the state in terms of its politics. And Carl attributed the change to immigration. And, you know, the truth is, I realized my own family exemplified that. We moved to Texas when I was a child. Daddy was a returning war veteran. He'd been in World War II in Korea. And like a lot of veterans, he was an Eisenhower Republican. And he moved to Dallas. And Dallas was the first of the cities in Texas to turn red. And my father was an expression of that. And as Texas economy took off and the great migration to the South and Southwest began, a lot of people came into Texas with different political traditions. And they changed the state and made it more Republican. And what's happening now is that same process of migration is happening at an even greater pace, but it is beginning to change the state towards the Democratic column. And even the suburbs, which have long been the stronghold of the most radical right, they're being disaggregated by these new immigrants.
The other thing that Rove told you, and you mentioned this in the piece that you did for The New Yorker before the book came out, is that these Republicans went, in his view, from being economic populists to being social and conservative populists who thought the government was the problem. And that, too, I thought was really interesting, given Rove's not only his influence on the Texas Republican Party, but the role he went on to play in the Republican Party at large in the country.
Yeah. You know, back in the days when Texas was blue, people supported the government because during the Roosevelt era, government was a lifeline to Texas, as it was to much of the country. But Texas in particular was crushed by the Depression. And had it not been for Roosevelt's programs, Texas would have been very, very difficult to recover.
And LBJ rose up through that. He was a product of that era.
Exactly. I mean, he affiliated himself as a young congressman with Roosevelt. And, you know, he saw the power of government to bring dignity and sustenance to people whose lives had been so impoverished and there's so few routes out of that kind of poverty. Roosevelt made a change in Texas, and LBJ had the same effect. He carried on that same tradition.
You know, Texas has had such a colorful parade of governors, and I want to just go through a couple of them. I remember Ann Richards when she was probably the first Texan governor I had ever heard of, and she was just an amazing sort of larger-than-life figure. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about her. She served from, I think, 1991 to 95.
Yeah, you know, she was a vivid personality. She was just even vivid to look at. If you saw her in the grocery store, and I saw her in the grocery store a couple of times when she was governor, she had that striking white hair done up in this pompadour that Molly Ivins, the political humorist, used to call hard hair because Anne sprayed it so heavily. She loved to dress in these couture dresses, but she'd clean her nails with a Swiss Army knife. And she was a down-home girl. And she had been raised in this very macho, environment, and she learned how to stand up against it. And the two of them, Molly and Ann, really carved out an identity for Texas women that still endures. I remember once Molly told me that she called Ann Richards when she was governor and to ask about this manger scene that had been erected in the Capitol, and the ACLU filed suit to remove it because it was unconstitutional. And Molly said, Annie, is it really necessary to take down the manger? And said, well, I'm afraid so. And it's a shame because it's about the last time there'll be three wise men in the Capitol.
And she was succeeded by George W. Bush and then Rick Perry. But when Bush ran for president in 2000, he went on to run for president, and his slogan was compassionate conservatism. How has the state changed since then, and in a way that reflects the bigger shifts we're seeing in the GOP?
The Governor Bush that we had was certainly a moderate figure. He was a bipartisan by necessity, because both the House and the Senate in Texas at the time were led by Democrats. So, you know, part of his campaign was, you know, that he was a bipartisan figure endorsed by those Democrats that led the House and the Senate in the state. And, of course, he became less bipartisan as president. But his defeat of Ann Richards really kind of marked the end of the Democratic Party as a force of any weight in the state.
And then the state Republican Party just became more and more right wing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when the Republicans gained control of the Texas House and began redistricting the congressional districts and the House and Senate districts in 2004, the gerrymandering had a huge effect on the state politics. For instance, I live in Austin. It is, by some metrics, the most liberal city in the entire southern tier of the United States. The hatred of Austin by our statewide officials is so intense that they carved Austin into six congressional districts. They had one historic district that Lyndon Johnson once represented. But we now have six people in Congress, five Republicans and one Democrat.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
I want to ask you about Governor Greg Abbott, because he's almost certain to win re-election in November. And for a time, it seemed that Democrats weren't even going to field a challenger, to the point I just learned from you, Larry Wright, that you were considering running for the job.
Oh, Dorothy, I was stirred up, I have to say, covering the legislature and seeing the priorities that they had presented, such as the bathroom bill and, you know, the sanctuary cities bill and so on. And, you know, I looked around at the needs that we have to be spending the time that they were spent on those divisive and culturally harmful pieces of legislation was a little infuriating to me. And also, Texas is expected to double in population by 2050, if you can imagine that. This state will be the size, about the size of California and New York combined.
That's just staggering.
So it is staggering. Our infrastructure is not even up to the task of supporting the population we have. And those things really stirred me up. And the fact that no one was presenting that perspective, I conceived the idea that if nobody else was going to do it, then I would step forward. But it, as it turned out, I couldn't even carry my own house.
So I want to actually ask you about one of these issues, because it was such a contentious legislative session in Texas that you wrote about. And maybe we should just focus on the transgender bathroom bill, which also was, you know, became kind of a model for other states. And it was just an amazing test of wills between the lieutenant governor, who is also the president of the state Senate. Do I have that right?
Yeah, the lieutenant governor's job is to run the Senate.
Explain his role in that bill and then his battles with the House Speaker.
Well, he had a list of priorities, and one of them was to enforce this notion that the bathroom that a person chose to go to had to correspond to the gender that was listed on his birth certificate. It was strictly a homophobic and anti-trans bill that was being carried to placate some of these homophobic funders that are stand behind these extreme right-wing conservatives. It took up an amazing amount of time during the legislative session. We only meet every other year for 180 days, so there's a limited amount of time where the major problems of the state can be addressed.
So how was it resolved in the end?
Joe Strauss, who was the head of the House of Representatives, simply refused to allow this bill to come forward in any real fashion. Finally tried to issue a compromise when the governor got involved in it. But the compromise wasn't satisfactory to Dan Patrick, so it never came to a vote. Then when at the end of the session, the governor called a special session. And part of the deal was they wanted to create some kind of bathroom bill that would satisfy Dan Patrick, but Joe Strauss wouldn't let that get through his house, and he paid a price for it. He was denounced by the GOP statewide. He finally decided not to run for re-election.
Abbott seems fixated, among other things, on California, as so many Texans do. Can you explain that obsession?
No.
You mentioned, by the way, that one of the members in your blues band, I think it was the drummer, has a sticker that says "Stop Californication of Texas Music."
Well, I think we all love Texas music.
Let's start just with the obsession with California. So what's that about?
It starts with the fact that California is the most populous state in the nation, and Texas is number two. Texas is growing. You know, it has 38 electoral votes already. It will gain 4 in the next census. Most observers agree. California will gain none, hasn't gained any since 2004, but it now has 55.
And has a larger Latino population, doesn't it?
We have about the same. Both California and Texas are majority-minority states. We're unusual in that regard, but that prefigures what America itself will be looking like soon. California and Texas are seen as these almost perfectly opposing political systems. California is known as, high government, high tax state, lots of regulations, and Texas is the opposite. Yet the outcomes in many respects are very similar. We both have very difficult time educating our population. The percentage of high school graduates, Texas is 49th and California is 50th. We have in Texas extremely lenient gun laws. California has very strict ones, but the number of people murdered by guns is about the same in both states, the homicide rates. And so it's puzzling, but the idea is that Austin is the spore of this California fungus that's destroying America.
That's vivid.
And, it has to be stopped at all costs. But when asked to cite the kinds of things that are California influences, Governor Abbott talks about plastic bag bans. And, restrictive tree ordinances. Those are decisions, made by voters in Austin that I think the state has no business getting involved in, but the governor is preoccupied by such things.
You know, Texas has, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the most unpopular senator, and that is Ted Cruz. Is that right?
Well, you know, he has a constituency in Texas. He's intensely unpopular in Washington, and he's done very little good for the state.
So he has a challenger this year in Beto O'Rourke, who has rejected PAC money and still raised millions more than Cruz did.
Twice as much in the last quarter. It's fascinating. I met Beto a couple of weeks ago. He was at a Fox channel in Dallas, and he struck me as a very appealing candidate, kind of Jimmy Stewart-like, and although Jimmy Stewart, who had been in a punk rock band in his youth. But I'm standing behind the camera watching the anchor interview Beto before he got around to me. And this is the Fox anchor. And his beginning statement to Beto was, "Well, you're really handsome and you're tall and obviously charismatic." And Beto hadn't really said anything at that point. I thought, well, we're on Fox News in Dallas. You know, this gave me a new appreciation for his candidacy.
So, but what do you think his chances are?
They're long shot, but it's not as long as, you know, as one might have thought. The things that are going against him, one is he's a Democrat. We haven't elected a Democrat statewide in 24 years. Two is he's from El Paso. And for whatever reason, we have never elected a Democrat statewide from El Paso. I don't know what it is that we have against that place. And then also going against him is there's a very weak ticket. You know, he's the only candidate statewide that has any real interest. Were there other candidates that people felt compelled to go vote for, it would probably help him out. And then also he's got a very, very weak party.
What's he campaigning on? What's his big issue?
He is the anti-Ted Cruz. He wants to have government be involved in the state. He wants health care for Texans. He's careful on gun control. You know, he talks about our precious Second Amendment, but he does want to make some changes in, you know, in terms of access to guns. This is a challenging issue for all political figures in Texas.
Even after the recent shootings?
Well, right at this moment, the governor has convened a three-day workshop to talk about, you know, gun safety. And I'm all in favor of it, although it's a closed meeting and we don't even know who's been invited. I doubt that there'll be any significant legislation to be proposed out of this.
So we do hear a lot about purple Texas and Texas turning blue because the demographics are so clearly headed that way. How soon do you anticipate that actually coming to be?
Well, Dorothy, it could happen rapidly because of, you know, the population of the state is so much more progressive and has a minority majority. The chronic problem with Texas is that people don't vote. Wendy Davis, who was crushed by Greg Abbott in the last gubernatorial race, said that Texas is not a red state. It's a non-voting blue state.
What? Why is that?
People say it's Hispanics who don't vote, and that's true. But if you take the question of ethnicity out of it, the people who don't vote are young and poor and poorly educated, and there are a lot of Hispanics in that category. In my opinion, you know, we have 29 million Texans. 19 million of them were registered to vote in the last presidential election, but only 9 million did. And so why didn't they vote? I mean, they took the trouble to register. Why did they not take the trouble to vote? I think, especially in terms of the Hispanic population of the state, it's the absence of compelling candidates who speak to their predicament. You know, we had one gubernatorial candidate in the past, Tony Sanchez, who would certainly not be considered to be a charismatic figure. Recently, just yesterday, Lupe Valdez, who was is the Hispanic lesbian sheriff of Dallas County, won the Democratic primary with the lowest voter turnout in 100 years in a Democratic primary. Whether that will be able to overcome the lethargy, the indifference, and the absence of any kind of voting habit, this will be told to us in November.
Yes, and we'll end on that sobering note. Thanks, Larry.
It's been my pleasure, Dorothy.
Larry Wright is a staff writer and the author of God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Hannah Wilentz for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.